Under the skin. Hello, so welcome to Under the Scales, and the Under the Scales studio is back in Princeton, New Jersey, and I'm really happy to have a couple visitors here today in the studio. First is a guy that you guys all know, a friend of the podcast. RJ's here from Helping Friendly Pod. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. You're always welcome. The door's open. The key's under the mat, as you know.
Yep.
And then I was really excited that a really cool car came all the way from Connecticut. The door opened and Holly Bowling stepped out.
Hey, hey.
Hi, Holly. So where were you guys playing last night? Where'd you play?
We were at the Acoustic in Bridgeport.
Bridgeport, Connecticut. Okay. And then, so you're on your way to Philadelphia, where I'm going to see you tomorrow at the World Cafe Live.
Yeah. Super psyched for that.
Yeah. And you were very nice to kind of stop, which is kind of on your way, which is very cool. So thank you. Thank you very much for doing that. You're also here with Jeff, I should mention, who's quietly hovering on the couch.
He's lurking.
He's lurking. He's a lurker. Jeff is a helper of all kinds. He's already helped immensely. So Holly is... a wonderfully classically trained pianist and also a super major Phish fan, having seen 300 plus shows. Is that correct?
Yep.
And then one day, and I was there, this thing happened to you where the two worlds sort of combine, and that was in July 2013.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us what happened?
Yeah, the infamous Tahoe tweezer. yeah, I went to the show, and as we all know, that was a tweezer for the ages, and I think I listened to it 5 times that night before I went to bed, and I listened to it, I don't know how many more times we squeezed in on the drive back to San Francisco the next day, but it was instant obsession. General, whenever I'm listening to a piece of music and get really into it for a while, I end up inevitably sitting down at the piano and working out bits and pieces of whatever's been rolling around in my head. And so that's what happened with this. And I was singing, you know, little bits of the melody and playing them on the piano. And then that just kind of became this tease of like, well, what if I could string all these bits and pieces together? And somehow that turned into the crazy idea of, well, I'm just going to write the whole thing out. I'll just do this, do a transcription, you know, and I did the whole melody line all the way through, just, you know, moving between instruments, whichever was kind of the dominant part.
Right.
And I figured I'd just comp the chords and the harmonies and stuff. And so months later, fast forward, I finished it and I sit down to play it and I'm like, oh, this is not good enough to just, you know, kind of fill in the harmonies.
Right.
It's like, this deserves more than this.
Further analysis.
Yeah. So I went back and ended up basically doing all of the parts and writing in 3 or 4 staffs at a time, and decided I wanted to treat this piece of improvisation more like a piano reduction of an orchestral work and actually try to capture all the textures and rhythms and different timbres and figure out how to explore that sonic space on the piano rather than just going for, oh, here's the melody and here's the chords. So basically, you know, the obsession just deepened and got worse and worse. I went further and further down the rabbit hole, and then
it's amazing.
Thank you.
the result is amazing. And kind of what you're doing, and this is sort of, to me, at least on the surface, is unusual. When I hear it, it totally makes sense immediately. But on the surface, to me, I was thinking, wait, so Phish took a song, jammed it out, and then now Holly transcribed it and turned an improv into its own separate work. Meaning almost you could take another tweezer and it would be a completely also separate work.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm treating the improvisation as though it were a composition.
But you don't improvise it. You play that the way it was played. You play that Tahoe tweezer.
Yeah, and in the case of these, what I've been calling jam transcriptions, where I'm treating a piece of improv as a composed work and rearranging it, I play it the same every time. And it's fully scored out note for note. If you look at the score, it looks like the score for like a Beethoven sonata or something.
And is it in your handwriting, or did you get someone to actually do pro it out eventually?
It's in my handwriting initially. I always work with pencil and paper first, and then I do put it into Sibelius afterwards so that I can
Sibelius being the music software that transcribes.
Right, okay. So it's actually a printed notation. But it's got, I mean, I have thought about where I want each voice to enter and how, and you know, what should be in the foreground, what should be in the background. So there's crescendos and accents and articulation markings and fingerings of how to get each spot right. And it's like scored down to, you know, not just playing the same notes every time, but really I've thought about how I want each note to sound and in what part of the space it should occupy.
It's incredible analysis that it goes beyond, you know, normally you hear a classically trained pianist, they know how to read music and play music. But you kind of, did you go to music school or something? Because writing music the way you do and analyzing it, it seems like this almost next level sort of talent.
Yeah, I mean, I studied classical piano performance in school, but I'm not really sure where this came from. That was not what I was learning there.
Well, that's cool. It's kind of like you explored and you said, hey, I want to do this, and you did it.
Yeah. You know, I grew up taking piano via the Suzuki method also, which I think has funnily enough played into this, you know, 20 years later. Let's see what I did there.
20 years later.
Because the whole premise of it is you listen to music and you're immersed in it constantly, and you don't learn it by reading. You just learn it by ear. And then later you learn the written representation that matches up with the experience of hearing and playing that you already have committed. And so this was just kind of an extension of that. You know, I was very much immersed in this music because I love it. And I've spent years, you know, chasing Phish around the country.
Chasing the dream.
As many shows as I can. And so, you know, I learned it by ear and then put it down in a written representation.
Yeah.
And,
well, almost aptly, your name of your Phish music album is called Distillation of a Dream.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like your dream. To me, it's like, you know, it's a play on devotion to a dream.
Of course. Yeah.
But you don't do that song.
No.
but distillation to me, kind of the essence of that word is purification or reduction. Is that correct? Do you think that way? Like, the way that I feel that you purify Phish's music is that you, one of three things kind of rises to the top. Like, I think you take four elements, and they're not the band members. I think the elements are Trey's guitar, which might possibly be at the top at the moment, Paige's piano, or the melody. Those are like the three top things. Is that correct? Would you agree with that? And then kind of as almost second, I don't want to say secondarily, but the bass is there, kind of always on your left alone with my mistakes on the left hand. See what I did there? Very clumsily.
We can do this all day.
Left the root, my playing takes left alone with Michael's bass.
Ba-doom.
All right, I'm not going to do that anymore. I promise.
4 minutes, it's gone off the rails. 4 minutes.
No, but so if you, all right, so I didn't let you answer, but let me just add one more thing to that recipe that I gave you for your yes or no answer, and say that you've kind of purified away lyrics, not the melody. So I'm still represented in there, but you've kind of, you can't play lyrics on the piano. And then similarly, in a way, drums, although it's a percussive instrument, and they're in there, and you can imagine them. But does some of this take a leap of faith by the audience?
It definitely does. And I don't, I wouldn't say that I pick particular elements and then always represent those. You know, like I'm shifting which parts of the music I'm bringing into focus or bringing into the light more.
In and out of focus.
Yeah. We really are going to do this all day, aren't we? there is a leap of faith there. Sometimes I'll try to, you know, represent as many elements as I can for maybe 8 or 16 bars, and then I'll let one of them fall into the background and bring in another one with the hope that the thing that we set out before is still rolling in the listener's ear. So I'm kind of creating like layers, you know, one by one, and they're still there in the background, even if I'm not literally playing each of those notes. Sometimes I'll take it down so there's just like a little outline of what I was doing before to keep it there, or I just trust that it's, you know, the listener's ear will continue to fill it in.
Right.
And, you know, the same kind of goes with the lyrics. Obviously, I can't play the lyrics on the piano, but I'm playing the melody with the lyrics very much in mind. And in fact,
you do. You even enunciate, like each word become, every syllable is represented in your playing, I hear.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm hearing the lyrics in my head as
right.
I play, to the point where I was mentioning how the score for the jam transcriptions is entirely written out and it's note for note, very, very carefully scored. A lot of my charts are not like that at all. In fact, they're not even charts. Some of them are just the lyrics on the page and that's it. And that's what I'm playing off of.
Because you know the music so well, or innately in a way.
I know the music and I know the lyrics too, but it's a, I really want the lyrics. I want to be singing them in my head. Very, very, I want them to be there very much in the forefront of my mind, even if they're not coming out through the instrument, because I think that thread still needs to be there.
Yeah.
So even though I'm not representing them, they're still represented in the music. And same goes with the drums. Like, obviously, I can't, you know, hit a cymbal at a key moment.
Yeah. It'd be kind of cool if you had one cymbal.
Right? I thought about that. Like, those old Nickelodeon pianos where you can hit things with your knee and your foot and... but no, so sometimes I'll actually alter the rhythmic patterns. Like if I'm sort of building an amalgam of what I hear, like the harmonies that maybe Paige and Trey are creating together, you know, if I mush them into something somewhat representative, and I think that Mike's bass line there is really crucial. So I'll play the bass line and then kind of mash what Trey and Paige are doing together.
Yeah.
But then I might take the rhythm that I hear the two of them creating and alter it to try to incorporate what I hear Fishman doing. So if has hits that that are really a part of the character of that part of the jam or the song, then
right.
I'll try to incorporate his rhythms into the harmonies that I'm pulling from the other two and put them all together.
I get it. So, now, so the jam transcriptions don't leave you much room for Holly stretching on stage, but do you, for like other transcriptions, like say Squirm and Coil, the end of that where Paige just sort of lets go.
Yeah.
Do you let that be Holly just letting go as well?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, of course. And, you know, it's just different forms of expression. Like the jam transcriptions, the root for my expression there is not improvising. It's about interpretation. And the creativity is in the arrangement of what I choose to put in there, what
yes.
I chose to leave out. And then also how I choose to play it, right? Like you
right.
can hear 10 different performers play a piece by Bach and they're all playing the same notes. That's not the creativity. The creativity is in the interpretation and what you choose to do with
uh-huh.
it. So with the jam transcriptions, it's the arranging and the choices made there. And then
yeah.
also how I play it and how I interpret it. But then there's all kinds of other stuff I'm doing where there is a lot of my own improvisation or, you know, sometimes like it's the song is a launch pad for 20 minutes of me letting go and doing whatever I feel like. And obviously that's still influenced by the initial character of the song.
Right.
But it's very much the antithesis of the jam transcription thing.
Yes.
Even though that was something turned on its head anyways, that was crazy improvisation that then became something that was entirely written down and
I totally
scored.
Get
and then,
it.
And then I have the opposite as well.
Now you talk about the audience making a leap here and there. Do you find, like I just went and saw, I don't know if you caught any of them, the three Trey acoustic shows, which are sort of an anomaly, obviously, for Trey.
Yeah.
The audience filled in, like Paige's part, for example, like in Limb by Limb. Trey said, I never want my hand cut off. And everyone answered, without even Trey, with no prompting, never want a hacking cough, never need a clip sign first, never turn up. So we all sang back to Trey. And then similarly, I think in Bouncing Around the Room, we all did that, and I awoke. And then Trey did the that time. The audience was doing that time then once again, bouncing around them. And mm-hmm. I think, well, anyway, it wasn't completely defined, but we are helping and Trey encouraged it. And that's, do you find, for example, I mean, I heard the audience do the woos in the time between on one of your videos. Do you find that audience will sing, or is it kind of more like there's, you know, like when you go to a classical show in a theater, there's no clapping. Is there kind of like no singing at your
you know, it varies.
There's dancing, I saw.
Yeah. I think people aren't really always sure what to do with it, you know? Like, do you sing along? Do you dance? Do you sit quietly in your seat and then, like, golf clap at the end? You know, like, what's the expectation?
I would sing if everyone was singing, but I don't know if you would like it. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you can come and sing at my show.
It is but a sort of genre of bending, because you're, like, jam band and classical.
Yeah.
At the same time.
And I don't ever want to tell anyone what to do at my show or how to experience it. The only thing is, I think that the space it's filling is like a different kind of musical experience than a lot of the other stuff that at least I, for example, go see. It's not this outward expression of joy and emotion and dancing and, you know, everyone having this crazy experience together.
It's reminding them.
It's still powerful, but it's inward. And it's like this quiet space to have that same kind of experience, but in a really different way. So, you know, if people want to sing, that's cool. I generally like it when the room is relatively quiet, because I think it creates that space for people to have this different kind of experience. But aside from that, you know,
I've heard people,
it's what you want
and
it to be.
I've seen comments and I've heard people say stuff like, I can finally play Fish at my office now. thanks to Holly. I think maybe lyrics are the enemy. can't possibly play that at my office.
Well, before we get too far, I just wanted to, you were talking about that we don't have to talk too much more about the Tahoe Tweezer, because that's, I think, how everyone or lots of people introduce you, or the first topic you talk about. But the idea of like your own expression of it, it's interesting. Like, we can debate the best tweezers all day, but like that was an inspiration for you to get into what you're doing now. And similarly, Mike Hammett, who does the Fish maps, his first Fish map was after that night after the Tahoe Tweezer.
Really?
He made his first, yeah. And so that's like two major projects that were inspired by this one piece of improv, which I think is really interesting. And regardless of whether you think it's the best or not the best or whatever, it's like in these different expressions, kind of taking lives of its own, which I think is just interesting and noteworthy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a powerful piece of improvisation. Clearly, it's inspired
a lot
of things.
Like, that's amazing that it, like, from that, these two different branches, a minimum of two. There's probably certainly art, you know, like drawing art and painting art created as well from it. Speaking of other jam transcriptions that made it onto Distillation of a Dream, I saw you kind of analyzing your transcription and arrangement of The Wedge, which occurred in Chicago, 7/20/14. I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm not like a listener to old tapes. So I actually went back and experienced the Tahoe Tweezer probably like my third or fourth time ever in my life. Like, I listen and then I'm done, kind of.
You never re-listen?
In general. Well, I have so many on my phone that when I go walking, and I walk daily, that if I'm in music mode, I can't help but re-listen, but I'll have no idea when they were played. I won't know what jam that is. I'll just know that I just had a great tweezer that went
it's
on.
It's just mystery jam theater.
Yeah, for 20 minutes, and it was amazing. very, very rarely will I recognize it. But this thing, this particular wedge that made it onto the album, thank goodness, because it was so cool, and I went back and found that part in the song, was you were playing, I think, a page part on your left hand and a tray part on your right hand, and you kind of had a conundrum. I'm not going to be able to say it as well as you do, but basically what your solution was, Oh, I know. Now I'll let them cross and let Trey be played by my left hand and Paige by my right hand. So the two things cross.
Yeah.
Now, is that like confusing in your brain, or is it just reduced to notes and you just play it and you don't have to think about it?
It's not confusing. It was just like a process of, I mean, with the guitar and the piano too, there's a lot, they're in the same range a lot of times.
Oh, right.
And you don't think about it when you hear them played because they're really different timbres, so they occupy really different space. But when I'm doing it on one instrument, I would have spots where my hands were literally on top of each other. Like, all right, this doesn't work. But when I stopped thinking in terms of like, okay, I'm going to put one part in my left hand and the other part in my right hand, and just started picturing these interlocking musical lines, you know, moving through the space, and just thinking of kind of passing the baton from one hand to the other. Like, the parts aren't tied to one hand or the other. They're here, and I'm just trying to, like,
yeah,
trace the lines, basically, wherever they take me. So right. That ability to, you know, pass them from one register or octave to the other.
That was intense. It was really cool.
It helps the arranging process a lot. It made me think about...
Just being able to. So that's like a technical ability that enabled you to more easily do that transcription.
Yeah, I mean, I think the music itself forced me to look for that solution. Then that became a skill that, like, I'll even find myself using in my own improvisation, you know, the ability to just pass it off from my right thumb to my left thumb and let the line keep going on down the piano.
It's amazing.
And change the texture that way.
Yeah, wow. That's very cool. You wouldn't want to play any Wedge for us, would you, right now? It's one of my favorite songs.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be Chicago Wedge. It could be any Wedge.
Oh, that's the only Wedge I want to play. Okay.
Would you mind?
Instantly brought back to that moment.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that's like part of the reasons why like people cry at your shows a lot.
It's triggering amazing memories.
A lot. And I think it's and part of it is without the words, mm-hmm. in some senses you hear, I mean, and I hear Trey singing my favorite version of that song in that moment. And I think that anyways, I think that's worth mentioning.
Yeah. I don't think the lyrics are absent. I leave a space for them for people to fill them in.
It's even more right because you don't have someone else singing them. You hear the lyrics, and mm-hmm. not just Trey singing the lyrics or Paige or whoever singing the lyrics, but you hear like your favorite mm-hmm. version of them.
Right.
And I think that's.
That's why I've really enjoyed my instrumental rendition of Ass Handed, because I can picture Fishman's voice in my mind perfectly.
I saw RJ starting to tear up too. Yeah. Mention that Ass Handed. When you mentioned that you don't want to tell people how to experience your shows, RJ, I could tell, instantly thought that that meant clothing optional.
All right, we're going to have to put some ground rules down. You're not coming to the show tomorrow, are you? Because we're going to...
No.
I do like that idea about lyrics, and it made me realize I kind of skipped something up here. I could ask you, Holly. So in addition to the jam transcriptions, you have what you call just regular interpretations. And my three particular favorites, I mean, there's lots of stuff. There's Silent in the Morning. There's, what is it? Horse Silent. There's Wingsuit. But my personal favorites are Talk, Sleep, and Waste. And I was thinking about those. They're not like as complex musically as any of your jam transcriptions, nor as even Wingsuit with some complex chord progressions and stuff. These are more things that you'd almost think require the lyrics for the song to have weight. And yet, something happens when I listen. Like, different listening centers are activated and perhaps some are shut down. And I love it. I do, like you were saying, Jeff, earlier, I find myself singing it and sort of reminiscing. And for me, my personal memories often are like writing, you know, how it happened. And when it's reduced to that sort of bare element, missing the lyrics, I am filling it in not only with lyrics, but with memories.
Nice.
Yeah. And so now do those songs, you add, you're kind of just singing it with your fingers, right? In a way. Is that kind of what, like, is there any rule, like, they have to be super complex for you to do? It doesn't seem like, it seems like anything's on the table.
Yeah, anything is on the table. It's not about complexity. It's more about what I think will carry well on my single instrument, you know?
Yeah.
There's some songs or jams that I love that I won't do, either because there's physical limitations of the instrument that it really can't do that. Like really fast repeated notes, or infinite sustain, things like that, that the piano just can't do.
The note in Divided Sky.
Yeah. There you go. Or because like, there's some songs that the drums are such a huge part of the character of the piece that I don't want to put it in a context, or filter it through a lens where it's going to lose a lot of what makes it what it is.
Like Walls of the Cave, there's parts that kind of rely on the drums. Or Limb by Limb or something.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, Taste is one of those too, right? But I manage, that one has enough motion in it somehow that I feel like I could still capture some of the like perpetual motion feel of the drums and some of the really interesting hits.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's the selection process is, it's not about like, oh, I'm only going to do the ones that are complex,
right,
or like technically difficult. It's not about that at all.
Right. For the computer savvy musicians among us, you already mentioned Sibelius?
Sibelius, yeah.
Sibelius as your transcription software. And I also saw you using a phone, and I believe it was just sort of playing back, and then you press pause on the phone and then play the piano.
Yeah.
What app was that? Was that just Voice Memo?
No. What is that called? I use it all the time. It's funny. I'll tell you this first, and then do you want to grab my phone out of there and look at it?
Because I just got off a writing session with Trey, and we use apps now a ton.
Yeah.
Like GarageBand, Voice Memo. I think Voice Memo is the
most. Have so much stuff on my phone as voice memos because I'm like driving and I think of something and I'm singing into my phone while I like to.
Turns out that there's a better voice memo. It's called Hum. So Hum has all the features of voice memo, but it also allows you to write. So you could write the lyrics, write notes. Whereas I find myself missing that in voice memo because I want to say, like, you know, Trey will do like 5 attempts. And I want to say why this one differs from attempt 3. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas you only have like 50 characters in voice memo. Hmm.
So the app that I use is called AnyTune Pro.
Oh, and what does that do?
Well, a feature that I don't use much, but one that people use it for is you can slow things down or pitch adjust things.
Oh.
I'll use the pitch adjust once in a while to bring something up an octave, especially if it's really low notes that Mike's hitting and it's covered by a lot of other textures or, you know, when I'm working on the dead stuff too, I'll bring that up an octave just so I can get a little more clarity. But I mostly use it for being able to set a amount of time, you know, and listen to like a 6-second clip and then be able to rewind and hear it again. So I can write down, you know, I'm writing as fast as I can. I can hear it as fast as it's moving, but I can't get it on paper quick enough. So it allows me to re-listen to the same points until I've got it and then move on. But when I was working on the Tahoe Tweezer transcription, when I first started all this, my process was terribly inefficient. Terrible. I had this, you know, 37-minute long thing on like iTunes or something on my phone. I don't know what program I had it in, but, you know, I'm like 20 minutes into it. And then hitting pause and then trying to go back and hear something that was 15 seconds ago and trying to move the little slider.
Impossible.
And like, oh, now I'm like 4 minutes back again.
Yeah.
So we ended up breaking it up into like 5 or 6 chunks. And then I was just working with those. After I finished this whole thing, I've started realizing that there were much more logical ways to go about it.
There's some other tools out there that are great.
Yeah.
It's kind of like my early podcasting experience. Podcast editing experience where you get, it takes you 3 hours to get through 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And you figure out more efficient ways of doing it.
Yeah.
You wound up you still use
Audacity,
which is a free piece of software.
But I played around with other tools that were not as intuitive for me personally.
And I use GarageBand, but I'm graduating to Logic.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, do you do any of your final, I guess there's not too, like, do you record with stereo mics and then kind of that's it on an acoustic piano?
I mean, for the albums, you mean?
Yeah.
I just went into a
You went into a studio.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they do whatever mastering it takes, and then boom, it's done.
They had a combination of closer mics and then stuff further away to capture the room sound. And
oh, cool.
Yeah, my engineer was a wizard. He made it sound really good.
Well, I'm the wizard that put a few mics here on this piano, but I understand there's like really easy pitfalls to fall into, where if you have two mics, you can get cancellations and weird stuff. So
yeah,
I'm gonna hope. I might just mute two mics and just go with one. We'll see what happens. There's various things you can do. So RJ, anything?
Just a quick question. I'm curious. You said you've found more efficient ways to do things. Is there like if you take a song from the beginning, how long does it take you to get from like, oh, I should do this song to, you know, playing it? Is it a weeks long process, or do you do one in a day, or how does that work?
It really depends on the song. Like, I've been working on an arrangement of Stash for months now, and it's still not, it's not playable quite yet. Not at tempo anyways. And
is
then,
that a jam?
It's not a jam transcription. I've just been working on the head of the song. But it just depends on the song. And it's also weird. Sometimes I'll have 2 days where I can just like dive in and really work on a song from start to finish. And then other times it's like a few minutes here, a few minutes there. I do a lot of my arranging and transcribing work on flights. I'll just put on headphones and disappear for 6 hours, wake up at home and, you know, come out of my my arranging cage.
It's expensive to buy all those planes.
Hey, you got to do what you got to do. No, but the biggest change in like a process for me, besides figuring out apps that were a lot smarter, was initially I would write out all the parts. So I was working in 3 or 4 separate staffs, and then I'd try to figure out which elements to grab and how that would be playable. And just as I worked on the Tahoe Tweezer transcription, by the end of it, since it's so long, my process had changed a lot, and I was doing a lot of that decision making in my head while I listened, so that then I could just write in 2 staffs and more or less get something that was playable on the piano. Even if I ended up making adjustments later, I was able to, you know, skip a few steps and just start to do that work mentally.
Did you start naming them in your head, like the parts? Because there's so many parts in Tahoe Tweezer.
Yeah, you know, Jeffrey actually named them, because he broke it up into these chunks for me. The names were really funny, too.
There's actually a friend of mine who named them, who's not even a Fish fan, who, like...
He kind of listened and heard things in them?
Well, because he'd heard so much about her doing the Tweezer, and we were posting videos before, like, it was a thing. And, like, so a friend who's not into Fish at all, like, had to go listen to the thing. And he's like, there's so many sections. And he, like, wrote down all these sections, like, barbarians coming over the hills and, like, these amazing stuff.
And then, like, angels descending from heaven. He had all these character names.
They were amazing. So when I broke
it. Snakes on a plane.
Yeah.
I had to use these names.
Yeah, so, like, the barbarian section, I think, was, like, the...
kind of from being there more than hearing it later. Yeah. But now I've listened to Holly's a few times. So.
Yeah.
So let me ask you something. This is sort of like combining the listener experience with you kind of as an advanced listener, because you've become an extremely advanced listener having to transcribe stuff. So like for example, like in Squirming Coil, Trey's chords, does he fall into like similar patterns? Like, it must make you appreciate his unique writing style. And like, I was wondering if you noticed signature writing techniques. For example, as a listener, we can hear something similar in Squirming Coil and maybe Horn, and possibly similar stuff in Spices and Pebbles and Marbles.
Ooh, Spices. I like that you brought that up.
I think those two are written together. That's why I can hear the similarities. Mm-hmm. And then other ones are like the initial piano intros of Vultures and Walls of the Cave. Similar sort of progressions. And I'm wondering if you, as a transcriber and an extreme student of their music, can you sort of say, you know, oh, there's that trick again. Or like, you kind of identify signature techniques that maybe Trey or Paige is doing, whoever is the composer.
You know, I don't sit down and like, I mean, I'd actually really like to, but I've never like analyzed Coil as far as looking at the progressions and how they're moving from one to the other.
There's some kind of interesting modulation that happens there that I feel happens in other songs, but I don't know if that's correct.
Now you're making me want to sit down and actually like do the chord analysis on these. And
but I'm almost thinking in a math, yeah, like almost like mathematically, like is he going from one chord to another and then uses that same technique? Or is that not something that you take each one at a time and you don't want to draw inferences because each one's a separate project.
It's not that I don't want to. I just haven't sat down and thought about them that way, but I'd really like to. Some songs, you know, sometimes when I'm learning them, I'll really, you know, kind of dive into, okay, not just what's happening here, but why? Like, what's the structure? What's the pattern? What's the overall, like, form? Is there a symmetry here? Is there a pattern? Is there like a code to unlocking?
Ah.
You know, why this is doing what it's doing.
There's a Da Vinci code in their jams.
Not in the jams so much as in the compositions. Ah. Like, so It's Ice, I spent a lot of time really digging into what's happening in each spot. Like there was certain patterns. Like I was trying to figure out what is, like, I know that there's a repeating loop here somewhere or a pattern or a shape or something that's the building block of this.
Ah.
And it wasn't immediately apparent to me. So I spent a lot of time trying to figure that out.
As a listener and a 300 concert attendee, you must sort of have already had like a guess. Are you saying that like the guess was wrong? Like as you...
No. I just had never really even thought about it. I listen in a really different way when I'm trying to transcribe a piece or learn a piece. And I try not to be really analytical when I'm at a show. Like, I'm not going to pick it apart.
So that's what I meant by
to like let go and have this experience and be carried away. You know, I try to turn off the part of my brain that's like, but why?
Well, I think that answered my question. So you turn on your advanced listener capabilities when you're transcribing. You turn it off and turn on your I'm a fish fan ears when you're at a show.
I think it's hard to turn off parts of your brain. It's always working like that at some points. But I don't go with the intention of like trying to get all mathematical or analytical about it. I go because I want to experience the emotion behind it, you know, and the feeling and the energy, not the nuts and bolts.
Right.
You know,
as a wise man once said, the trick was to surrender to the flow.
You got yours in. There you go.
You should point out, he was talking about repeating stuff. You should point out some of the repeating stuff you hear in the jamming, though, because there is different segments. I mean, you talked about the down with this or the Dick's disease and stuff, and the kind of like you do hear repeating phrasing in.
Oh yeah, that's something interesting. I mean, I think so. There'll be little riffs or certain chord progressions, and I don't think it's that that they get repeated more than in the past. I think it's just because I've spent so much time with particular pieces of improvisation. Like if I've been working on transcribing a jam. And then any pattern that's remotely similar to that shows up in a new one, my brain is instantly like fireworks going off, like, oh, that's a lot like this, you know? And so there was this, you know, the Dick's Disease jam, not G major ascending. Is it G major or D major? I don't know why I'm asking you this.
I think we're about to find out.
But it's this, well, I've transposed it a few times, so it might not be in the right key, but this... phrasing here, but that progression, I kept hearing it shows over and over again.
Interesting.
Because my mind was, you know, it's like that movie Pi, right? Like once you're obsessed with that number,
Pi is everywhere.
You're gonna see it everywhere. Yeah. It was like that kind of moment.
My daughter pointed out, I forget which album it was, I think it could have been Joy, where Trey in a bunch of songs had this segment in his solo, and I think I'm going to butcher it, but it's something like do 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 do, and we started listening, and it was like, yeah, that is in Gotta Jabu, and that is in name a song, and it was kind of like we could hear it everywhere. It's kind of funny. So whatever they're, you know, on at the time, I don't mean it that way. Whatever riff they're on at the time, you know, it kind of gets stuck in their heads too, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you get patterns in your fingers or in your mind. There's muscle memory and you know, and then there's things that are just part of your style.
Right.
You know?
Do you find the way that a band, especially in your, I guess only in your jam transcriptions, rises to a peak or a crescendo is similar, because it's kind of like they're getting the audience built up. It's kind of like this massive thing.
Yeah.
That from song to song, jam to jam, might be similar. That might be something you...
Yeah, you know, I think more the thing that stands out to me is eras, you know? And it's funny, like with the jam transcriptions I've tackled, most of them are 3.0. And like when I try to figure out why that is, aside from the fact that I tend to work on stuff that I've just recently seen because I'm excited about, you know, really good shows.
Yeah.
You know, the way that like that Phish would build up the peak of a jam in like the early 90s was so tension and release and dissonant and super, super fast repeated, like, you know, machine gun tray notes or whatever, yeah. Is really different than like the very melodic build up with like these motives and stuff in 3.0. So more than seeing like a song to song parallel, I feel like I see it just eras, because
interesting.
I mean, the way that they peaked, you know, a song in 92 is really different than the way that they peak the same song now.
Yeah, okay, right. So absolutely. That's very cool. That's very cool.
And like the 2003 is an interesting year for from that perspective, because there are so many beautiful jams that were more patient than in years before. Have you tackled any of those, like the NASA Tweezer?
Ooh,
or any
I
of those
do
from
love
03?
That one,
because they're not super fast, but they're complex and beautiful.
I haven't tackled that one. I have a very long list.
Yeah,
of
I bet.
Jams that I wanna. To work on, mostly just because getting to spend that much time with them and pick them apart and doing that kind of like really...
And buying all those airline tickets.
Yeah. No, that's a function of the fact that I'm on the plane anyways. But no, like that kind of really deep listening where you're not listening while you're doing something else,
yes.
But you're just sitting down and listening to right. music for hours on end.
That's valuable like, time.
It gives you such an appreciation for what's going
but
on.
But it's also hard to find that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when you force yourself to do it, then you discover all these things, even in, you know, songs or jams that you thought
yeah.
you knew inside out. You're like, oh, there's still more to love here. Yes.
Do you find that you're surprised? Like, is 3.0, some, you know, some fans have complained that there's less jamming. You kind of just sort of characterize it as different jamming.
Yeah.
Do you find that there's like more exciting stuff happening per era, or is it just different and you can't put exciting on any era?
I really just think it's different, honestly. Like, I know
you're still discovering cool stuff.
Yeah, and I'm glad it's not the same, man, because
yeah.
I think that would be boring for everyone involved. Like,
that
it's
is like
it
the
should
message.
Evolve.
That's what I tell people when they, you know, when they, any kind of complaint, the band is not static. They're not going to always play the Tahoe Tweezer.
Yeah, nor should they,
right.
You know?
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I know that, you know, if you're going to stack up minute to minute, you can look at 1.0 versus 3.0 and be like, well, the jams in general were longer and more patient. And like, I mean, yes. But I don't think I would characterize the 3.0 jams as impatient. It's just instead of having this super long time scale where things kind of percolated to the surface gradually and then everyone locked in and that was like the theme of the jam, like a lot of this 3.0 stuff is just more dense melodically. Like there'll be a motive that comes out and everyone's on it right away. They lock in, they build it up, and then they throw out a new motive. And so there's like different themes to each jam. Huh. That come pretty rapid fire, I feel like, rather than having this long stretch time scale and really like staying. I mean, if you look at like the Went Gin, right? It has
yes.
it has one character, you know, one little motive to it that you can play, and everyone's like, oh, of course, I know that.
Even me.
That's interesting, Holly, because we've talked about that a lot on our podcast. Is I attribute that to them just being more experienced and better musicians now, like after and having going off and doing their side projects and learning different things, and it does seem like they come together more quickly and are able to change more quickly, which I guess that sounds like what you're saying. It probably makes it harder to transcribe something when it's changing every couple minutes.
I think it actually works really well for what I'm doing, mm-hmm. because the really long stretched out stuff, oftentimes there's a lot of interesting timbral stuff going on there, right? It can be really textural. And that's very hard to recreate on a single instrument, whereas when it's like changing melodies and motives mm-hmm. and stuff, it gives me a lot of raw material to mm-hmm. work with. But I couldn't possibly, when you were saying maybe it's because they're better musicians or they've brought these other influences in, I can't even begin to speculate on motives. I can only only observe like what the music sounds
that's
like
fair.
To me.
I'll
so.
Thank you. Hey, so thanks for listening to part one of my interview with Holly Bowling. I found her conversation and music so compelling that we just kept talking. It wasn't our intention to stretch to more than one episode, but it happened. So tune in on the first Monday of May for part two of Holly Bowling on Under the Scales. Now listen to her version of Sleep. But don't go to sleep if you're driving.